Welcome to M&A Access, the official podcast of the Alliance of M&A Advisors. My name is Gina Galush, and I'm the Executive Director of Membership. Today, we have with us Mindy Passmore. We're really excited to have her here. And honestly, I've been a little bit of a secret admirer from afar, so I'm excited to get to know you.
Thank you. I'm so honored and happy to be here, Gina. Thank you very much.
Oh, you're very welcome. It's our pleasure. So tell us a little bit about your background, how you got into what you do, what it is you do now, and what you've kind of learned to specialize in.
Sure. Well, I've done a lot of things in my past. I came out of public accounting and went into industry up the CFO track. Then I spent about 6 years as a CIO, a chief information officer, doing a large-scale company transformation of information technology and implementing an ERP system. And then I went back on the CFO track. I decided to leave corporate America because I was just ready to go out on my own and do something different. And so I ended up being a fractional CFO for a while. But my whole career has really been focused on growth companies, on mergers and acquisitions, both divestitures as well as acquisitions. Mm-hmm. And I spent a lot of time doing tuck-in type things when I was with the larger companies. And I saw business owners that have worked for a very long time sitting across the table from fairly sophisticated buyers, both private equity as well as corporate buyers. And I always felt like I wished that I was on that other side to help them because it was such an uneven playing field. And so as I got into the fractional CFO work, I realized that I had some clients that were doing some transactions, and I was actually able to help one client avoid a really bad deal. And at that point, I decided that I wanted to be on the other side of the table officially. So I started my own company. And right now, we do M&A work, both buy and sell. And we also do investment banking. So we're also helping growth companies raise funds. And we also help companies and owners prepare their businesses for deals, which I feel like is very important. There is a huge difference in the outcome of a deal, even whether or not a deal will be successful, when a company is prepared, and also when owners are prepared for letting go of their baby, so to speak. So we focus on that, and we believe it is a game changer for our clients. Mm-hmm.
That kind of makes you a good one-stop shop in a lot of ways because you can help prepare them and you have that relationship of preparing them for during the transition. You can then be, you know, lean into that relationship that you've built over time. That makes total sense.
That you're absolutely right. And it, beyond that, one of the things that is people don't necessarily think about a lot, let's just take the sell side, for example. When they're thinking of selling their company, it's how do they position that company to potential buyers? Mm-hmm. What makes them different? Why would someone want to buy the company? And so early on in my career, I worked with McKinsey. I wasn't a McKinsey consultant, but I led a corporate project with McKinsey. And so what I learned to do is strategic planning and really bring that for my clients. So if I look at strategic buyer potentials, how would it fit? How would my client fit with them in an acquisition? How would they fit with a private equity group? Why would they be a good platform? Where would be the roll-up opportunities? Mm-hmm. And so being in there early actually gives me a chance to really get to know them and to really help them build that story and then be really focused about how we go to market.
Mm-hmm. No, that makes total sense. And it gives them that time because not all of them know about all of those options and what those different options mean for their baby that they built over those years, you know, so it gives them time to process that too. I love that.
Yes, and also we concentrate a lot on the after-deal happiness of the clients. So I have seen numerous examples where entrepreneurs sell their business and then they're not happy. Maybe they were part of the management team going on after the deal, and it's very hard for an entrepreneur to switch from being an owner to an employee. So we really help make sure that they get the right partner, they build the right questions. If they're going to be staying on, that they can ask and get to know and have a relationship prior to the deal being done. Because even if they're going to be there for a year, two, or three after a deal is done, it's part of their life. And life's too short to be unhappy. So we really try to focus on that as well.
So when you prepare them for happiness, what's the kind of, do you put them through a questionnaire of what they're looking for from this, what they want out of life in general? How do you work through getting to that end goal of what will make them happy when the deal is closed?
Well, that is a great question because it's so individual. So I would say in general, first of all, for the business side, mm-hmm. we do have a questionnaire. We do have a pretty robust assessment okay. that we customize for each client and for each industry, as well as for what we know about the buyer market at that particular time,
right.
because the buyer market does change. And so we try to make sure that the business is ready and what they address what's important, if not everything. You know, we rank the priorities. But then on the personal side, I think it's really important for the owner to understand what do they need to live on from a financial perspective, making sure that their spouse is engaged as well if it's appropriate in that situation. And really, you know, understanding what having them very cognizant of what life is going to be like after the deal, because a lot of times their whole personal life, their friendships, everything is tied up with people in the company. So we make sure that they know what they're going into. And we do have a very robust trusted advisor network. So if, for example, they don't have a personal wealth manager, a financial planner, we will refer them to someone. And we do have, we have experience with exits and with psychology. We're not psychologists and we don't do that, but we can refer them to someone if they need to talk to somebody personally as well.
Well, that's very interesting. I could see the spouse being an important part of the equation for sure, and a good source of input.
100%. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you know, the spouse at the last minute, if they're not brought in, they can basically cause a lot of issues with the client.
Right.
Now, this is mostly on the sell side. If you look at the buy side, we still look a lot at cultural readiness. At one of my past big corporations that I work for, we became experts. It became a core competency in acquiring businesses to make sure that we had a checklist down to the very, you know, 24 hours before who was doing what, and making sure that the business people are informed at the right time, that the messaging is right, all of that. And so I've always carried that forward, because acquisitions can fall apart from day one by not handling the HR side. And so we really try to help beyond just getting a deal done, although that's very important for us, is understanding what the client wants, expectations either way, buy or sell or fundraise, but then making sure that afterwards that they're set up for success and have, you know, the chance to really get the value that they're trying to get out of the deal, regardless of which it is. And the same goes on the fundraising side with, you know, it sometimes raising capital sounds easy, but now you have a new partner, someone that you didn't work with before, or you have a new lender and you're having to meet financial covenants. So again, we try to make it so that there's no surprises, and we try to teach and coach as we go.
Okay, so question for you. You said you went out on your own. Tell us that story. Like, how did you lean into that? How did you know it was time? How did you know you were prepared for that next step?
Well, I had been thinking about it for a while, for many years, and I just never was brave enough.
It takes so much guts.
Yes, and when I left my last corporate America job, I was tired, and I said, you know, I really want to do something. My son at the time was starting his own business, ironically with horses, and I have a horse farm, and I've been involved in a small horse breeder and performer for a while. So I took a year off and helped him kind of do a strategic plan. And then I started meeting people, and I decided that I really wanted to help private company owners. Mm-hmm. And so I ended up being trained as when I was a fractional CFO in marketing and sales, and it changed my paradigm about it. It was like, well, I'm not really selling anything. I'm helping people. So that was what launched me. And then, of course, when the AM and AA, I joined that, and the regulations changed, allowing non-registered intermediaries for M&A transactions. That's when I thought, well, now I can do this legally for the just that small portion. And then later on, I kept having a lot of people come to me needing to raise capital. I had a management buyout that I was involved in, but I couldn't be the intermediary for it because I wasn't licensed. And so then I decided to go ahead and get my investment banking FINRA exams and pass them.
You seem like quite a student. I've seen on LinkedIn there's a lot of certifications you take, and I remember one post you were like, I just got my series something, and next time I'm going to get my series something. You know, so it seems as though you are constantly looking for what is the next thing to learn. How do you decide what is the next thing to learn?
Really based on, it's kind of based on what's coming to me. So, you know, in that case, I had demand for fundraising and I couldn't help people. And I wanted to be able to help people. And so it was a pretty easy thing. I did some homework around which of the series exams do I need. And so I took the 79 and 63. And that's what I need for the investment banking, raising capital. There are other series exams that are four more things like private wealth management, other investment management, that kind of thing. So people that are wealth managers and that the trade securities have to have different other series.
Right.
So, I really value that. I will say, Gina, the AM and AA education programs are fantastic. I really like them. They're very topical and they're very timely. So as you know, the M&A market changes drastically from quarter to quarter even. And I make it a priority to attend the conferences. I've learned so much from the conferences, from meeting people, and also from the sessions, because the sessions are always about current topics. And then the classes now that are being offered on demand. You know, I got my CMNA a few years ago, and just staying current is to me very, very important, because I really have a passion about providing the best service that I can, mm-hmm. and the best client experience. And that means I have to stay current and my team has to stay current.
Absolutely. I love hearing that, because that's one of my passion projects. When you talk about helping people, that's one of my favorite ways to help people, is to get them the information and the education they need, because with that, you can do anything, really.
100%. And, you know, I don't forget on engagements that we're consultants, and it's my job to lay the options out for the client. And things are complex a lot of time, either in a buy, sell, or fundraise deals. And so, you know, really being able to give them that expertise advice and then letting them have the ownership. Mm-hmm. One of my colleagues had a great comparison for it. She said, Mindy, we're Yoda. We're not Luke. Luke Skywalker, that's the client. We make them into the heroes. And we provide the Yoda, and sometimes the Han Solo.
That's amazing. My husband would be very proud of that reference. Total Star Wars nerd. So the Yoda, and the Yoda has to be, you know, like what you were talking about, has to have that wisdom to lay that out and to lay out the offers. How do you cope with, when you lay out the offers and the options as a consultant, and you see your client going down a road that you don't think is ideal, what do you do in that moment? Do you ask questions? Do you make suggestions? Do you say, okay, that's their road?
Well, I start with asking questions, mm-hmm. you know, because a lot of times people don't understand really what all of the implications of the decision. So I start asking questions, and sometimes I find out that they've thought of something different. They have, of course, great industry business knowledge that I don't have, and I bring the deal, the financial, the business strategic experience. And so it's just a conversation. And if it's something that, you know, that I wouldn't do, or that I'm really concerned will hurt them, I will say, you know, I'll put it in a way, something like, you know, I've been thinking about this and here's my concern about it. I don't tell a client, don't do that, because that's not my priority, prerogative. It is more, you know, here's the big concern, but I do make sure that they understand my concerns mm-hmm. and potential consequences of decisions that they are thinking about making.
So when you started your business, you went from kind of C-suite to taking a break and reexamining where you want to be with your life and that kind of thing. What has been your experience as a woman who started her business in a rather masculine industry?
Well, I would say I thought about that question a lot, actually, because I've been asked that before. And really, I don't feel different. And I have, as a result of that, I haven't had anyone treat me differently. When I came into public accounting out of college, university, I was the first start group of professionals there that had an equal number of women and men. Mm-hmm. And I rose up through the ranks there and then went into industry. And I've always had more in industry, more men than women, because I started out fairly high in the management structure, even out of public accounting. And I've never felt like I was treated differently, really. I think it's because I don't present myself differently. And, you know, I feel like, you know, I hold myself to a high standard. And I'm going to be learning what I need to learn and doing things professionally in the right way and the best that we can. And I feel like that's good enough. And, you know, I feel like I've not been singled out for being a woman at all, and really not noticed a huge difference. However, I have been sensitive to younger women. And I do have a passion about helping them and younger men as well. One of my favorite things that I did in corporate America, looking back, was mentoring and growing the team. And some of my team members did super well. And so I've always felt proud of that. And I've carried that forward with the team I have today as well, is passing it forward. Again, not really treating them differently because they're men and women. But I feel somewhat connected to the women, because there are difficulties and differences. I think it's becoming less now, especially when you have a family. I had three children coming up through a pretty challenging career. For a period of time, I was a single mom. It is tough. And that probably was the biggest difference, is just the family side of it. Mm-hmm. And so I would say now, of course, things are a lot more open. Men want to be with their families as much as women do. And I'm really happy to see things change that way. Because when I was coming up, I got some compensation because I was a woman. But the men, my male colleagues, did not get that break a lot of times. And so in that regard, you could say it benefited me being a woman. And now I'm seeing things level out. And I think that's really fantastic. But I think it's really, it's difficult to, you know, have children and have a very demanding career. So, you know, I try to support my team. If I have clients that are going through that, you know, always an ear, whether it's a man or a woman, because it's tough. So I would say that would be the main thing, difference that I think that I saw coming up.
Do you think, you said something at the beginning that I felt was the crux of the matter. You didn't feel different, right? And so you didn't approach anything differently. Do you think that really was the difference? Because your generation, there are women who would say otherwise, right? In this industry. And so personally, I feel rather similarly. My dad was someone who just raised me to go out and get it, you know, and that there wasn't really a difference between me and someone else. He was a business professor, which kind of helped. But, you know, when women mentioned it, it was something that I didn't really think about as a professional woman at all until someone else mentioned it. So do you think that really is maybe part of the difference. It is hard to be a mom and a working mom with more than one kid or just even one kid. You know, that's a lot of your brain's in a lot of places, right? Your priorities are in a lot of places. But, you know, what we focus on and the way we approach things because of what we're focused on can make a difference.
Yeah, I think you're right. So, Gina, my background similar to yours. My dad was an engineer, and I have one sister who's a little younger, a year younger than me. And both of us, it wasn't like there was an option about going to college. School was very important. There was no excuse. They expected us to make good grades and to do very well. And so for me, there was growing up, I never felt different because I was a girl. I was treated by my parents and my family, you know, agnostically, I guess you could say. And so when I went out into the workplace, I had a good work ethic and I made it happen. And of course, coming out of accounting, you know, getting an accounting degree and a CPA and going to work for, at that time, one of the big eight firms, you know, I had a good job so I could afford to pay for some daycare and such. Yeah, I think it was the same thing for me. It's just never, and you know, I never really dwell on it. It wasn't like I dwelled on that. I was more focused on, you know, getting the work done, doing it well. I was the person that would volunteer for the hard projects coming up in my career because I liked the challenge. I liked to problem solve. And so I never really used that as an excuse. The only thing that I did when I got into the CIO role, I was in the finance function at that time. I was the chief accounting officer, and then because I had good relationships and a lot of reasons within the company, I was able to become their first global CIO. I did ask my youngest son, who at that time was going into high school. I said, I'm going to have to be traveling a lot for the first year or two. Do you mind? And he said, no. And so I just made sure I was home for all his big events, all his big high school events and everything. And he said, Mom, you know, I want you to, you know, I've always felt like you were there. I want you to go and pursue this because it's an opportunity that, you know, you deserve, you've earned. And so I did. But that was really the only time that I had such a big decision about my taking a position.
Right. I think, too, the important thing was that you asked him to opt in, right? And you took him into consideration when you made that decision, right, as well. Because not all parents do that, you know, and that does make a big difference for our kids when we give them the option to opt in.
And it was hard back in those days because it was a little bit more autocratic in a lot of companies. You know, you get offered a promotion, and, you know, if you don't take it, then there could be some consequences. Yes. Not that I thought that at that time, but it was just kind of the way corporate America mm-hmm. was mm-hmm. at that, you know, and it was during my careers mm-hmm. in corporate America.
So when you started your business and you went out on your own, there was never a thought in your mind of, I'm a woman, I'm breaking a glass ceiling, anything like that. You were just like, this is what I need to do, and this is what it's my next step, and we're going to do it.
Yeah, I was focused more on the fact that I had a lot of knowledge. I think mm-hmm. helping my son with his strategic plan, and then there were some family members that called me, and I was helping them as well, and some other people just kind of, you know, found out, well, you're kind of in between. What do you want to do? We're going to call you. So mm-hmm. I just had so much fun helping entrepreneurs that I thought I have a lot to give, you know, and I really want to do this. And I was very inspired to do it. I think the biggest reason why I didn't go out on my own before is I wasn't really sure what I could offer or how I would do it mm-hmm. or, you know, how I would, quote, sell my consulting services or, you know, what it took to go out, you know, and be an entrepreneur myself. But I will say having been an entrepreneur myself makes me really understand a lot more how my clients feel. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that phase when I was a fractional CFO really helped me understand their feelings and how they thought. And a lot of entrepreneurs, most of them think differently than corporate, large corporate executives. They're just a different mindset. Mm-hmm. And there's a different level of of decision making and a level of urgency when you're an entrepreneur, especially if you're really successful.
Oh, interesting. I would have thought it's the other way around. If you're not being successful, there's a lot of pressure there, you know? But I can see what you mean.
Well, I think either way, if you're not being successful, that's a whole nother ballgame.
Right.
But those that are successful have a real sense of urgency because it's real to them. A lot of them have built their company from when they struggled early on. And so they know what it was like. And I've also found that most entrepreneurs that I've worked with really care about their clients, their people, their employees. They really care. And so the founder, the CEO of a private company, a lot of times has a big responsibility for their people. And when we go into deals, a lot of times they're thinking about their people. And they're not just thinking about the cash that they're going to get. Mm-hmm. They're thinking about, yes, it's nice to have what I, you know, cash in what I've earned all these years, but my team, you know, brought me here. So there's a lot of what I see, a lot of concern and caring for people and sense of urgency because there are a lot of people depending on the business.
Absolutely. Okay. Can we switch gears?
Okay.
And talk about your personal passions?
Okay.
How did you become a horsewoman?
My grandfather had horses.
Okay.
Had Arabian horses.
Oh, Arabians!
Yes.
Nice.
And they were, we would go visit him, you know, once a year in Indiana. Mm-hmm. We lived down in South Texas. Mm-hmm. So it was a big deal. And I just remember seeing he had a beautiful white stallion that would run in the front pasture. And I would go out and watch that stallion. And of course, I read all of the Walter Farley books. And had, you know, every one of them, Black Stallion Returns,
yes,
all of those. And I really wanted a horse. And when I got married, it was not my first marriage, but my husband said, you know, I'd like you to have a horse. And I said, he actually, one of his friends wanted to give us a horse for a wedding present. And so
that's the best wedding present ever.
I know. And at that time, my kids were in, you know, school, middle school, high school, and a whole lot of activities. I was doing, a C-suite job in corporate America. And I just said, I don't think I can do that. And I don't know where we would keep it. My husband wanted me to have it. So he went out and researched stables, and his famous last words were, I'll help you. So now we have a horse farm, and I compete in Western dressage. I ride, train in English, and I've won some regional championships with my Arabians. So, but that's how we ended up with horses. I never thought, you know, you'd go on. It early on in my career, it just wasn't feasible.
Right.
But
you give me hope. Because I am a crazy horse girl. I just stuff it way down because career, four kids, all that jazz. So you give me hope that there is still time.
Of course. There's always time.
That's awesome. So dressage is really precise.
Yes.
And it takes so much kind of subtlety and training. Where do you see the parallel between that and your work?
Well, I think our work is the same. It's very disciplined. But there's also, you know, in horsemanship, it's very much about the partnership. Mm-hmm. If you try to force a horse through a movement, ultimately at some point it's going to break. So to me, I always put the relationship first with my mm-hmm. horse and, you know, make sure that I have a mare and a gelding. Make sure that they are that they're ready physically, mentally, and you learn to communicate with subtleties with horses, mm-hmm. a flick of an ear, the way they roll their eye, whether they really want to come to you or not when you come out there, when you're bridling, do they turn their head towards you or away? It tells you how they're feeling. So just understanding them and really understanding the way they feel with every encounter. And also they hold me accountable. They hold me accountable for being, you know, for getting my act together, for having a good seat, for having the skills, but also for being a good partner to them as well. If they're having an off day, really understanding that. And I think that translates to everything, to all relationships. The horses, I think, have made me a better professional, a better parent, a better friend, and a better spouse, all the way around, just because they're so in the moment, and they teach you. So I feel like as much as I've taught them, they've taught me three times more.
All right. Well, thank you so much for this conversation. It's been great to hear from you in terms of your journey. That's wild, going from accounting to CFO to CIO to, you know, mergers and acquisition. That's such a great journey with many twists and turns. And it seems like you've conquered it well.
Well, thank you. And it's been my pleasure. And, you know, once again, I'd like to say thank you to the AMNAA. You guys have been a huge part of my journey. Really, I feel like I couldn't be here where I am today without you guys.
Oh, well, I would say we feel the same about members like you. Thank you so much for joining us. We hope that you take a few of these pearls home with you to apply them to your work, and we hope to see you next time.